aspartame, 200 times sweeter than sugar, and it is a brain reprogrammer. It is an excitotoxin, as they call it. It plays with the chemistry of the brain and the way the brain works, just like fluoride does, just like mobile phone frequencies do, just like monosodium glutamate does. Pilots, military pilots, are warned not to drink. Some years ago, they were warned not to drink lots of soda with aspartame in it because it affected their ability to fly. And I watched young kids swigging back this stuff full of aspartame. And they said, oh, we've got a problem with his behavior. Now, where did aspartame come from? When 90-odd percent of the independent data said it shouldn't be used for human consumption. Aspartame, man. It's amazing, because of this pyramid structure, how the same names keep coming up in different places. Donald Rumsfeld now wants to go around bombing people at will, and he was hired by Searle Pharmaceuticals because of his connections into the Republican Party and the Reagan-Bush administration to get aspartame through the vetting authorities and into our drink and foodstuffs. Because of that and the changes that were made to the vetting authorities relating to the aspartame checks, he did that. And then he sold out to a vast profit, Searle Pharmaceuticals, to Monsanto. And you know, it might sound kind of, oh, it's negative, this stuff, but actually it's bringing it to the surface where it can be dealt with, so that's a good thing. And I never heard of ignorance ever being positive myself, but it's actually saying something about us. The way they are bombarding us from every direction, it says what we really are. Our natural state is multidimensional connection. And what they are having to do in all these different ways is to hold us in an unnatural situation by bombarding us constantly. I've used this analogy a number of times. If you get a ball floating on a tank of water, its natural state is to float. If you want to put it in an unnatural state, you need to push it down and hold it there. Once you let go, woof, it's back. And symbolically, that's what they're doing to us, or trying to. They're trying to hold us in a natural state at the bottom of the tank in all these different ways. And that says something incredible about us. That when we remove this stuff, boom, we're in our natural state. We don't have to find home. We are home. This stuff is designed to make us forget who we really are, especially at this time. So, this is, as I say, the structure going through history, which is certainly the situation today, where everything comes to one point. Now, there are two major mass mind and emotional manipulation techniques that are desperately effective, so simple, and they're being played on us all the time. And once we realize, and I know this from my own experience, once we realize these two techniques, then the veil lifts on a massive scale. If these techniques were known by the mass of the public, then selling 9/11 and the London bombings and stuff would be so much more difficult. One comes out of this Freemasonic motto, Ordo ab Chao, order out of chaos. It used to be called the Hegelian dialectic. I changed it some years ago to problem, reaction, solution. Problem, reaction, solution is the greatest weapon that this network has in pushing forward its agenda. Very simple. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, will know it, but for those who don't, who will listen to this, this is how it works. You want to change society in a way that you know if you do it openly, you're going to get a massive reaction against. You want more and more surveillance, more and more control. You want a war on terrorism. You want microchip people, identity cards, and all this stuff. And so you don't announce it openly. You don't say we've had a meeting and this is what we're going to do. You play problem, reaction, solution. First stage, you create the problem covertly. could be a terrorist bomb, it could be a 9/11, a run on a currency, a government collapse, stock market collapse, whatever. You then tell the public what you want the public to believe about that problem. Now this is a piece of cake because of the media we have. If we had a media that was any way connected to the word journalism, problem, reaction, solution couldn't work. Because the official story would be given out, real journalists would investigate and check it, and they would communicate their findings, it's a load of crap, to the people who would react in a different way. What are you lying to us for? And so the stage three, the solution to the problems you have covertly created, changes in society that advance your agenda, would not be possible. But because of the media, you have the problem, you have the cover story of the problem communicated undiluted to the people, you get the reaction, fear, outrage, something must be done, and then those who created the problem got that reaction, then openly offer the solutions to the problems they have created. I've just described 9/11. This is George Bush. You're free, and freedom is beautiful, and you know it'll take time to restore chaos out of order, order out of chaos, but we will. This is what we're being faced with all the time. It is so simple and so devastating, but only while people are not aware of the scam and the way it works. Second World War, you had this Illuminati, this elite, who were controlling the Soviet Union, and they were controlling the Allies, and they were controlling the Nazis. They brought them together into conflict in the Second World War, and at the end of the Second World War, the second global conflict in just a few short years, people were mentally, emotionally, and physically exhausted. What did they say? Something must be done. This can't go on. What are they going to do about it? And what was the solution? An explosion of global centralized institutions, financial, political, etc., that centralized power in the world on a colossal scale. Problem, reaction, solution. And this is happening all the time, where two sides playing out in the public arena are ultimately controlled by the same force, and even to a quite a high level in the two sides, they don't even realize that. 9/11. Problem, reaction, solution. No need for prophecy. What they've done is told us what they were going to do before they did it. Be fair. They use two techniques, problem, reaction, solution, and they use the other one, which I call the totalitarian tiptoe. You're here, you know you're going there, but you know if you go in one leap, even those watching Wheel of Fortune might go, honey, what's going on? There's a big change going on. Who won that, honey? So what you do is do little steps, or as big a steps as you can get away with. And every step leads you along to where you know you're going, but everyone is projected to the public as unconnected to all the others. And eventually you get down there and you look back and you think, crikey, how far have we come? What's going on? Exactly what happened with the European Union. It's just a free trade area, nothing to worry about, very good for jobs. That's what they're saying about, you know, CAFTA and all that stuff now. And then they say, oh, well, you know, it will be much better and more effective and efficient if we just had a bit more centralization here and a bit more centralization there. And eventually you've got the centralization of power in Europe, which you have now, problem, reaction, solution, and the totalitarian tiptoe. Talking of which, in September 2000, an organization called the Project for the New American Century, set up in the 90s by the people that have controlled the Bush administration since it came to power, produced a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. America, forget America, America's the vehicle, it's an Illuminati. Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces and Resources for a New Century. September 2000, just before Bush won the first election. The people that set up this organization were people like Dick Cheney, who became vice president, Donald Rumsfeld, who became Defense Secretary. Paul Wolfowitz, who became Deputy Defense Secretary and now, of course, is head of the World Bank. Please have mercy on the developing countries now. Also involved in creating it, Michael Ledeen, infamous of the connections into the far right in Italy. And well, he's so far right, he meets himself coming back, this guy. Richard Perle, one of the key neocons, as they call them, neoconservatives, just a name for an Illuminati grouping. Richard Perle, one of the architects of the invasion of Iraq. Woolsey, the former head of the CIA. Douglas Feith, major player in the Defense Department in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and stuff, and all the other stuff with Afghanistan after 9/11. Jeb Bush, brother of Georgie Boy, and William Crystal, who you'll see on Fox News all the time, putting the neocon, we must bomb everyone and all that stuff point of view, and he runs a newspaper, a Murdoch newspaper, which is a propaganda sheet for all this. Another guy involved is Frank Carlucci, thrown out of at least two African countries for involvement in assassinating their leaders. Another big player at one time in the CIA and also the Defense Department, very close to the Bush family, etc. Head of the Carlyle Group, which I'll come to at the time of 9/11. Another one of these neocons involved in this network and stuff, John Negroponte. Whoa, what a background this guy's got. United Nations ambassador at the time of 9/11, key position to push the invasion of Afghanistan and so on. Then he became head of American operations in Iraq, and now he is head of all intelligence operations in America. This is what I'm talking about early today, where they place their people in the positions of power necessary to orchestrate this agenda. This is what this document said in September 2000. It called for American armed forces, called them the cavalry on the new American frontier. It says that key allies like the United Kingdom are the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership. Exactly what has happened. It says the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification to go into the Middle East, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. This is all before Bush came to power. It calls for a blueprint for maintaining global U.S. Illuminati preeminence and shaping the international security order in line with the Illuminati's principles and interests. This Illuminati grand strategy must be advanced as far into the future as possible, and the U.S. must fight on behalf of the Illuminati and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars as a core mission. They've just announced, you saw it in the last couple of weeks from the Pentagon, that they want to change the nature of the way the US military operates so it can fight simultaneous wars. That phrase was actually used. This document says that peacekeeping missions demand American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations. It highlights September 2000, North Korea, Syria, Iran, and Libya as dangerous regimes, and says their existence justifies the creation of a worldwide command and control system, world army. And what happens is either they come into line, like Gaddafi in Libya, or the bullets start to be fired. Now, you'll remember the Axis of Evil speech by Georgie Boy, one of the State of the Union addresses. His speechwriter at the time was a guy called David Frum, one of these neocons connected into the Project for the New American Century and the American Enterprise Institute. They're all different names for the same force. He wrote the Axis of Evil speech. And what was the Axis of Evil? North Korea, Iran, Iraq. Straight from the pages of that document in September 2000. When they came to power in January 2001, they came to power, the Bush administration, controlled by the people behind this organization and this report. This is in September 2000 again. It spotlights China for regime change, saying it's time for a presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. This could lead to American and allied power providing the spur to the process of democratization in China. It's what I've been talking about. And years before, I'd said that. The plan is to engineer events, etc., etc., using the Muslim world and China. This document calls for the creation of US space forces to dominate space and total control of cyberspace to prevent their enemies, i.e. those exposing them, using the internet. The internet was a twin-edged sword for these guys. First of all, it made it real easy to track people through email and their movements around the internet and get a profile of them, but it also allowed information to circulate that they didn't want. Now they are trying to pull back on the bit they don't like, and they're going to do more and more of that using the war on terror and stopping terrorism as an excuse. And wait for this. People say the Nazis disappeared in 1945. They just changed the jackboots for business suits. This document talks of developing biological weapons that can target specific genotypes. This may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. These are the people running America, and these are the people, in terms of mentality, that are running United Kingdom and other places too. Now, this document said this. This process of transformation will be necessarily slow, it said, long, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. 1 year after this was produced, 9 months after they came to power with Bush, we had what Bush called publicly our Pearl Harbor. Coincidence? Are you kidding? I go into the 9/11 thing in detail in this book, but I'm going to go through it here and connect it into all the things that may not seem to be connected but are right up to the present day. That was the real reason for orchestrating 9/11, to create a massive problem, glean a massive reaction, and therefore offer the solution of massive change. Again, the secret agenda is global centralization of power. The movie is we must stop terrorism. Well, stop doing it then. Dick Cheney called it a long, dirty war, a war that will not end in our lifetimes. That's the idea. How can you ever say you've won a war on terrorism? You can't, so you have to keep fighting it. That's the idea. That's why they've not gone for a conventional Second World War type situation. They've gone for the war on terror. The idea, I mean, it takes my breath away. This man is actually president of the United States. You know when he was at the G8 conference in Glen Eagles in Scotland, he rode his bike into an English policeman. You know that? He did. The policeman had to go to hospital. And then the next day, after the London bombings, he said the American people have to be vigilant. He can't be vigilant enough to miss an English policeman standing in the grounds of the Glen Eagles Hotel. The idea that George Bush is making the decisions is frankly ludicrous. Cheney is by far the power in the White House, and he's far down the chain of events and chain of command in terms of the Illuminati itself. These are front people. Another man feeding control into the boy wonder is his father, President of the United States. This man has some history. Born into a elite Illuminati family through his father, Prescott Bush, became head of the CIA, United States ambassador, head of the Republican Party at the time of the Watergate situation, became vice president and then eventually president. He actually had three terms as president. Two were officially given to Reagan, who was the front man while Bush was controlling the situation. We then went to Clinton, who is very subordinate to him in the hierarchy, and then we go to his son. This man has had a massive influence on what has unfolded in this country for such a long time. That's a bit like the situation we're facing. And I love it when the newspapers say, George Bush said. No, George Bush read. Let's get it accurate here. That's all that goes on. And George Bush read actually rather badly. Then there's Tony Blair. See, the reason that you can't get a cigarette paper between Bush and Blair is they're both controlled by the same force and singing from the same song sheet. That's why you couldn't get a cigarette paper between Blair and Clinton either. It's no kind of great mystery. They're told what to do by the same people, so they do the same things. You know, it's just straightforward. And this is a very, very relevant expression of what we're looking at. Alice in Wonderland. Nothing would be what it is because everything would be what it isn't. And contrary-wise, what it is, it wouldn't be, and what it wouldn't be, it would, you see. Smoke and mirrors. What the? Basically, they went that way. If that's where it's all going on, they want you looking here. Smoke and mirrors all the time. But in their desperation, I have to say, the smoke and mirrors are getting less and less dense to be seen. The Illuminati, not least because of their genetic nature, which is very ritualistic in the way it expresses itself, they are incredibly predictable. And I guess on another level, if it works, why change it? 60 years before 9/11, we had Pearl Harbor. A problem reaction solution to get the United States into the Second World War. Franklin Roosevelt, when he was running for his second term, went through the mantra over and over again. You can see it in the transcripts. I tell you, mothers of America, your sons are not going to fight in that war in Europe. Why? Because they need the cross or whatever to get him in. He's not going to say, ah, yeah, when I get in, we're going to fight that war in Europe. We're not having that. No, your sons are not going. We'll have that, Franklin. He knows they're going in the war. It's on the song sheet. So when he gets into power saying they're not, just so he can get into power, he then has to, with his orchestrators, create a problem situation where he can take America into the war but be in the clear. As many books in great detail have documented, they manipulated and antagonized Japan in many different ways to get them to attack. And they had many different confirmations that the attack was coming from Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and they did nothing because they wanted the problem. And when it happened, what happened? They said, we must go into the war. We don't want to, like, but we can't have this. And oh, we're not going into the war against Japan, we're going into the war against Germany and all the others. Between the wars, a document came to light, which was actually held up by a congressman, and nothing was done, of course. It was a document that came out of Britain, of course, and it was called Propaganda in the Next War. A guy called Senator Nye was the guy who held the thing up and said, what the hell's this? This is what it said. This was before the Second World War. To persuade her, the United States, to take our part will be much more difficult. So difficult as to be unlikely to succeed. It needs a definite threat to America. A threat, moreover, which will have to be brought home to every citizen before the Republic again take arms in an external quarrel. The position will naturally be considerably eased if Japan were involved. And this might, and probably would, bring America in without much further ado. At any rate, it would be a natural and obvious effect of our propagandists to achieve this, just as in the Great War, they succeeded in embroiling the United States with Germany. Fortunately with America, our propaganda is on firm ground. We can be entirely sincere, as our main plank will be the old democratic one. We must clearly enunciate our belief in the democratic form of government and our firm resolve to adhere to the old goddess of democracy routine. 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, problem, reaction, horror, solution, America's in the war. Roosevelt said he never would. And they're playing exactly that on this now. Like I say, they're predictable. 6 years before 9/11, Oklahoma. And as a result of Oklahoma, changes were made to remove further freedoms. Clinton called within 24 hours of a greater militarization of domestic law enforcement to meet this threat. Timothy McVeigh got the blame for it. And again, as with 9/11 and the London bombings, there are some common themes and red flags. First of all, the fuel fertilizer device in the Ryder truck could not have caused that damage unless the laws of physics were suspended for that day. A guy called Brigadier Ben Partin, who spent a lifetime in weapons and explosives in the American military at a high level, wrote a 500-page report after Oklahoma, sent it to the media and all the people in politics, saying that it is impossible for a fuel fertilizer device to have caused that damage because when explosives pass through air, they lose power very, very quickly. The only way, he said, that that building could have fallen as it did was for explosive charges to be on some of the pillars in the building. Exactly what other people have said. The FBI could have produced the video evidence to show what happened with Oklahoma because they confiscated all the video stuff from the cameras around the area, and they said that they had to because of their investigation. When they brought McVeigh to court, all they had to do was play the video and then go for a cup of coffee. Okay, it's all over. They never produced the videos of what happened because the cover story would have fallen. And even when the trial was over, when they were asked, well, let's see the videos now, they said we can't because of national security. No, the security of the official story. And that's one of the great red flags to watch for. When us seeing something or hearing something would support the official story, we see or hear it. When us seeing or hearing something would destroy the official story, we don't see and hear it. Dead simple. And you can see it all the time. McVeigh was supposed to be doing this bombing as an attack on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms because of their involvement in the Waco horror 2 years earlier. Why then did he park the van with the bomb about as far away from where they were as you could? Why, if he, as one of the witnesses against him, said, again, someone who was given a lot of support by the authorities, they said that McVeigh had gone and cased the joint and looked at the whole area and the building and everything. So why, on the day of the bombing, did he go to a gas station and ask the way to the Murrah Building, therefore connecting himself, the Murrah Building, on the morning of the bombing? Why, as some of the families who dropped their children off at the nursery there, never to see them again alive, why did they see the bomb squad around that building in the hour and a half before the bomb went off? When they were asked, the authorities said there was not any bomb squad activity. When the evidence was overwhelming, they said, oh yes, it was an exercise. Now that's going to be a recurring theme in the next hour. So what we're looking at with Oklahoma was one of the totalitarian tiptoe steps to the totalitarian American society, which 9/11 was designed to advance and did massively. Now, finding out what actually happened at Oklahoma was quite straightforward. If you let bomb experts into the rubble, they will establish basically where the bombs must have been and the material used. Instead of that, the government hired a company called Controlled Demolition to remove the rubble where it was kept under guard by a company called Wackenhut, that is a CIA FBI front and is very, very, very close to the Bush family. If seeing or hearing it would destroy the official story or investigating it, you don't do it. The Bush family weave through this all the time, going way back. The guy in the center there is Prescott Bush, the present president's grandfather. He was involved in companies closed down during the Second World War for participating with the enemy. They were Nazi companies. He was involved with the Harriman organization. And he was very much involved in a company called the UBC, the Union Banking Corporation. And this was an interface between the Harriman operation and a guy called Fritz Thyssen and his steel and banking empire in Europe. And Fritz Thyssen was acknowledged as a major funder of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. And what the Union Banking Corporation were doing was funneling money out of America from these major Illuminati families through the UBC into Fritz Thyssen's operation and into the Nazis. And this is one of the reasons why the Germany economy went from fantastic thousands of percent inflation to a major war machine in a dramatically short time. They were funded externally. We went from Prescott Bush through Father Bush down to the present Bush, a dynasty, a royal dynasty. At the time of 9/11, one of the key organizations still, but very much then, was the Carlyle Group. This is a group that specializes in buying up companies, defense companies, weapon-making companies, that depend on government contracts but aren't doing very well because they're not getting too many government contracts. They buy the company up and stands back in amazement. They suddenly get massive government contracts. The chairman at the time was Frank Carlucci. Told you about him. A major player in the Carlyle Group was Father George Bush, and so is James Baker, Secretary of State to Father Bush at the time of the Gulf War in 1991. These people were massively influential in the network that orchestrated the whole period that we're involved in now. The Colin Powell, the first Secretary of State under Bush, actually called in his book Frank Carlucci my mentor. I wonder if Frank Carlucci and the Carlyle Group had any influence in the State Department when Powell was there. Frank Carlucci was a roommate at Yale of Donald Rumsfeld, Defense Secretary. I wonder if the Carlyle Group had any influence in the Defense Department. And a classmate of Rumsfeld was James Baker. It's a very rarefied world. And on behalf of the Carlyle Group, Father Bush was very, very much involved with the Saudi royal family and the Bin Laden family, the Bin Laden construction family, who were clients of the Carlyle Group. The first oil company, appropriately called Abusto Energy, because anything to do with Boy George goes Abusto, only he ends up smelling of roses and everyone else loses it. One of the people who invested in his first oil company was Salem Bin Laden, head of the Bin Laden family and the Bin Laden construction family, Osama Bin Laden and all that. Also, they're connected, like I say, into the Carlyle Group. And this is how silly it gets. When a bomb blew up the Khobar Towers, killed a lot of people in Saudi Arabia, including Americans, it was blamed on Osama bin Laden. Guess who got the contract to rebuild the bloody place? Bin Laden Construction. All in the bloody family, it is. There we go. Movie agenda. After 9/11, we must get Bin Laden. Oh, really? A Newsnight program in Britain, BBC program, and a very good reporter, he's an American called Greg Palast. He investigated the background to this, and he came up with this FBI document, case ID and all that, and it was code, FBI code, for a case involving national security. And the Washington field office of the FBI, special agents, produced this document. It was an investigation into Abdullah bin Laden, brother of Osama bin Laden, and treasurer of an organization called WAMI, that is a suspected terrorist organization, according to the bloody many organizations, including the State Department. But what Palast was told, and what he said in the report, was I received a phone call from a high-placed member of U.S. intelligence, a U.S. intelligence agency. He tells me that while there's always been constraints on investigating Saudis, under George Bush it's gotten much worse. After the elections, the agencies were told to back off investigating the bin Ladens and Saudi royals, and that angered agents. And what turns out is that that investigation into Abdullah bin Laden and WAMI was crushed and not allowed to go ahead. This is before 9/11. Also in this report, he interviews on camera a guy called Michael Springman, who was U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, center headquarters of the bin Laden construction empire. And this was when Father George was president. And this is what Springman said. In Saudi Arabia, I was repeatedly ordered by a high-level State Department officials to issue visas to unqualified applicants. These were essentially people who had no ties either to Saudi Arabia or to their own country. I complained bitterly at the time there. I returned to the US. I complained to the State Department here, to the General Accounting Office, to the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, and to the Inspector General's Office. I was met with silence. What I was protesting was, in reality, an effort to bring recruits rounded up by Osama bin Laden to the US for terrorist training by the CIA. They would then be returned to Afghanistan to fight the then Soviets. This is how the Al-Qaeda operation was manifested through the CIA and the Saudis and the Pakistan intelligence and various people. The foreign secretary, or former foreign secretary in Britain, a guy called Robin Cook, who resigned over the invasion of Iraq, actually wrote an article recently in a newspaper after the London bombings and said that the name Al-Qaeda actually means database, and it comes from the fact that the CIA had a database of so-called Mujahideen people who were fighting with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and that's where Al-Qaeda actually came from, a bloody database at the CIA. The immediate aftermath of 9/11 had people who were Muslims or even looked like them being rounded up all over America, and even their lawyers not knowing where they were taken, people kept in captivity for long periods without charge or trial. The same time this was going on, a private chartered plane was allowed to leave Boston Logan Airport, ironically, with the members of the bin Laden family on, getting them out of the country. Also connecting into the Carlyle Group was the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, the BCCI, which was a operation which was funding these terrorist groups on behalf of the Illuminati and also washing drug money and stuff. And the reason the true nature of the BCCI didn't come out was it was blocked by basically two people. The President of the United States, Father George Bush, and John Major, the Prime Minister of Britain. Both are now major players in the Carlyle Group. Just a coincidence, nothing to worry about. A guy called Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was named by the State Department at the time of Clinton as a funder of terrorist groups, including Osama bin Laden, was another investor in a Boy George energy company, Harkin Energy. He was also involved with the Carlyle Group. So wherever you look, the people who are supposed to be doing the damage are connected to those that are supposed to be stopping them doing the damage. Khalid bin Mahfouz and a guy called Mohammed Alamoudi were said by the State Department to be funneling money to the Capital Trust Bank, through there to Islamic charities and Osama bin Laden, and they were doing business deals with the Bush family. Another guy involved in the war on terrorism was this guy, John Negroponte, and still is, of course. He's now head of U.S. intelligence. He was UN ambassador at the time of 9/11, like I said earlier, key position for pushing this invasion of Afghanistan and other things. This is what John Pilger, a journalist worth the name, wrote about him some years ago. How appropriate that John Negroponte is Bush's ambassador to the United Nations. This week he delivered America's threat to the world that it may require to attack more and more countries. As U.S. ambassador to Honduras in the early 1980s, Negroponte oversaw American funding of the regime's death squads, known as Battalion 316, that wiped out the democratic opposition while the CIA ran its contra war of terror against neighboring Nicaragua. Murdering teachers and slitting the throats of midwives were a speciality. This is the man who is now running American intelligence and trying to stop terrorism. And of course, he was head of operations in Iraq as well. So in the run-up to 9/11, all the people who were blamed for it and the forces blamed for it were interconnecting with the Bush family on a business and other levels because agenda and movie. 9/11, problem, reaction, solution. This guy, a major placeman for the Illuminati, Tony Blair, that's why he keeps winning elections, he said this after 9/11. This is a moment to seize. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us. Problem, reaction, solution, exactly what 9/11 was about. The problem: four planes basically simultaneously hijacked in American airspace. And in that period of, what, 2 hours or so while it was going on, the apparently most powerful military force in the world did absolutely nothing that made any difference whatsoever to the outcome. Why? This guy, Leroy Fresher Prouty, who was involved in special operations during the Kennedy administration, said this about assassinations, but it totally applies to what we're talking about. No one has to direct an assassination, it happens. The active role is played secretly by permitting it to happen. This is the greatest single clue. Who has the power to call off or reduce the usual security precautions? That applied to the assassination of Kennedy. It applied to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and clearly the assassination of Princess Diana when the security was down to virtually nothing at the time she died. That's what happens all the time. Again, for such a simple reason. If the real level of security is there, what they want to happen won't happen. So remove the security and let it happen. 9/11, a classic example. Where the hell were NORAD? NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, has the role of defending American airspace from attack. Not only American, but Canadian as well. This is what it says on its own website. They are partners in protecting our homelands, deter, detect, and defend against air and space threats to North America. Now I just wonder, I feel it in the water myself, I just wonder if four airliners basically simultaneously attacked over American airspace might just constitute attack on North American airspace. I just wonder. And NORAD are there to react to this. In the whole period that it happened, there was no reaction that made any difference whatsoever. NORAD's operational headquarters is at Cheyenne Mountain, in 2,000 feet into this granite mountain. And inside, they have the state of the state of the state of the art tracking and communication technology. They are part of the process of guiding the space shuttle. They have direct connections, communications into the Pentagon. They are connected into the satellite system. They're watching about 8,000 pieces of debris floating around in space. They also pride themselves, indeed boast, that one of the great ways that they make the American military effective is they are able to guide them from a distance logistically because of all the communications and tracking equipment they've got. If a missile goes off somewhere in the world, they know about it. When they were asked, why did you not react earlier to these hijacked aircraft, their reply was basically, no one told us. I smell something fishy there myself. This is some of the inside of Cheyenne Mountain that they allow us to see. Incredible operation, and they can, you know, someone has a gin and tonic on an aircraft, they basically know about it, you know. And this is some of the scale of tracking equipment that is available. This was in Airman magazine, talking about the capabilities of the Global Hawk unmanned surveillance plane, of which more shortly. This is what it said. On an early test, for example, Global Hawk flew 56,000 feet over the Naval Weapons Center at China Lake, California. The images it gathered were so clear that an electro-optical image stands out next to an F-A-18 fighter. An infrared image showed where concrete had cooled down from the shadow of a C-130 that had recently taken off. And they got that from 56 sodding thousand feet. And they can't find bin Laden. And they couldn't react quicker to what was happening on 9/11. Please. One of the stories that kind of tells the tale is the one of Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon, which I'll come to in a second. I mean, that was just an incredible example of how this was orchestrated non-response. What's supposed to happen, according to the official regulations, is once a transponder connection is lost and or connection to a cockpit, then the air traffic control tells NORAD, they launch jets and they go up to find out what's going on. Of course they do. You can't have for aircraft flying around American airspace that's lost contact with the ground. The case of the golfer Payne Stewart was an example of how this operation works all the time. He took off in a Learjet, and because of decompression problems and stuff, everyone went unconscious, and it was flying on autopilot. What happened was, NORAD were told by air traffic control, they launched jets and they tracked it across America until it ran out of fuel and crashed in a place where no one was going to get hurt. That's what they did with a Learjet, with a 757-767, nothing that made any difference to events. The Federal Aviation Administration, the government civilian part of this operation, the air traffic control and stuff, if the timeline that I was given by NORAD and was confirmed by them is true, so it seems it is, then this organization has massive questions to answer about non-reaction, but they're questions it's not being asked by anyone in authority or the mainstream media. Interestingly, the guy who was running security for the Federal Aviation Administration at the time of 9/11 was this guy, Michael Canavan. His previous job was head of psychological warfare and special operations. Quite a career move, I feel. He left the FAA shortly after 9/11. Now, like I say, this one is the Flight 77 is an example that kind of encapsulates the whole thing. You are, according to Mueller, the FBI chief at the time, you are highly professional hijackers who have been orchestrating this for years, he said. You know, because you only have to go on the internet to find out, what the reaction operation is, the system, to hijackings. That is, the authorities launch jets to go up and see what's going on. So, you take off from Washington Dulles Airport, and your target, we are told, is the Pentagon just down the road. So, these highly professional, years in the making terrorists and hijackers have a wonderful plan to confuse people. What they do is fly in a bloody plane 45 minutes into the Midwest. They then hijack it and fly it 45 minutes back to hit a building down the road from where they took off. Yes, that makes sense. It is insane. It is ludicrous. It is the official story. Those two statements are interchangeable, by the way. And it hit, or so we're told, Flight 77 hit the Pentagon without any response from the most powerful military operation in the world when it's flown 45 minutes back from the Midwest to hit the headquarters of the American military. Are you kidding? What they did was launch jets to react to Flight 77 coming in from the Midwest from Langley Air Force Base, 130 miles away. And they all just didn't get there in time. Little question. Why didn't they launch them from the Andrews Air Force Base 10 miles down the road, where they protect the Washington airspace from? I rang NORAD, and I said to them, who defends this airspace across Washington that no one is allowed into? You know, around the center of Washington and stuff. And who defends this airspace? They said, it's the civilian operation. Oh, you mean the FAA? Yeah. So I go to the FAA and I said, how do you police this no-fly zone over Washington? They said, oh, we just do it as appropriate. Well, what the hell does that mean? What's the point in having a no-fly zone over Washington if you're policing the bugger from 130 miles away? Little bit of a waste of time, one thinks. Of course, where it's policed from is the Andrews Air Force Base. Why then did they not react from there on 9/11? Because it would not have had the effect if they had. The DC Air National Guard, the Capitol Guardians, brackets except on 9/11, say that they protect Washington from attack. So what they say on their website, the DC Air National Guard is located at Andrews Air Force Base. We're home to the 113th Wing, Fighter Squad, and all that stuff. The DC Air National Guard stand ready to respond to the needs of the District of Columbia and the nation should the need arise. Except on 9/11. Why? This is what they said recently. You know, these planes are going into the airspace and these little planes in the airspace over Washington. This is what they said. It happens all the time. When a small private plane recently entered the 23-mile restricted ring around the U.S. Capitol, two F-16 interceptors were immediately launched from the Andrews Air Force Base, just 10 miles away. In a similar episode, a pair of F-16 Fighting Falcons on a 15-minute strip alert at Andrews Air Force Base was airborne from Andrews just 11 minutes after being notified by North American Air Defense Command of a Cessna straying towards the White House. Bloody 757 heading into Washington. Oh no, hey. Wheel of Fortune's on. The 9/11 Commission, which was designed to find nothing that challenged the official story, said NORAD mistakenly sent jets assigned to guard the nation's capital to positions over the Atlantic Ocean. Well, that's a hell of a mistake, isn't it? An order by Dick Cheney to shoot down hijacked planes did not reach pilots until 30 minutes after Flight 93 crashed. I mean, you know, did the mobile phone system go down? I mean, what's going on here? No one was talking to anybody. The commission said that FAA controllers lost track of Flight 77 for 36 minutes because of a glitch in the radar system. Isn't it amazing how everything went wrong at the same time? The FAA was slow to react and there was confusion about what to do. Well, it's amazing they're not confusion any other day of the bloody year when they're doing this as a matter of routine. This is what the hijack response regulations say, the official regulations. The escort service, which is that sending jets up to escort the plane to the ground, the escort service will be requested by the FAA hijack coordinator by direct contact with the Pentagon Command Center. If you are in doubt that a situation constitutes an emergency or potential emergency, handle it as though it were an emergency. By the time this Flight 77 Pentagon plane was identified, two planes had hit the World Trade Center. Do you think that might just constitute an emergency? I mean, it's so bloody obvious what the game was, and it was so bloody obvious, therefore, the 9/11 Commission was about putting the lid on it. Now, it gets funnier. Not funnier in a funny way, but funnier in a, oh my God, way. People think that the official story from the start was that they launched jets from Cape Cod to try to head off the planes going into the World Trade Center, and then from Langley to Flight 77. They think that was the official story from the start. Oh, no, no. On September the 13th, General Myers, the acting head, now real head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest uniformed position in the American military, he was asked on Capitol Hill when the order was made to launch jets in response to the hijackings of 9/11 2 days earlier. This is what he said. That order, to the best of my knowledge, is the head of the sodding military. Did he not ask? That order, to the best of my knowledge, was after the Pentagon, Amos in there, was struck, General Richard Myers. So what he was saying publicly was no jets were launched until the Pentagon was hit when three planes had crashed into buildings. September the 14th, the day after that, CBS said that they'd learned, jets were launched from Cape Cod to meet the planes, or try to, that hit the World Trade Center. September the 15th, the Boston Globe went to NORAD and said, look, this is what CBS are saying, you launched from Cape Cod. No, said NORAD, we didn't scramble any jets until the Pentagon was hit. Then, miraculously, on September the 19th, over a week after the attacks, they issued a press release, NORAD, saying, actually, yes, we did launch from Cape Cod. And that is now the official story ever since. They made it up as they went along. And the reason they had to do that was not launching jets until after the Pentagon was hit was so ludicrous, even for watchers of American and British television. Now, here's another coincidence. We had the exercise going on around the time that the Oklahoma bombing happened. What has come out since 9/11 is that on all days of all days, a series of exercises were going on September the 11th, and some involved reacting to hijacked aircraft, airliners, over American airspace, including one hitting a building. just a coincidence, nothing to worry about. What they do is they put exercises on as a cover for what they're really doing. So if anyone gets caught, they were part of the exercise. And also, people can be pulled into it thinking they are part of an exercise when really they're part of the real thing. It's very clear that when Kennedy was shot in Dealey Plaza, there were two CIA teams operating. One that was operating to kill him, and one that involved Lee Harvey Oswald was operating on what they thought was a fake assassination attempt to be blamed on Castro to justify an invasion of Cuba. This is why Lee Harvey Oswald realized immediately he was a patsy. He'd sussed what had gone on. And they had to kill him through Jack Ruby, another man connected into the gang, so that he wouldn't spill the beans. What was going on, as we'll come to, during the London bombings? There was an exercise at exactly the same place as the bombs went off again. And this is what they do. And what happened in terms of the exercises on 9/11 is they scrambled and confused the reaction to the real hijackings, because people were saying, is this part of the exercise? Is this real? And the whole thing was scrambled, exactly as planned. The top three people in the military are General Myers, head of the uniform level, the Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and the Commander-in-Chief George Bush at the time of 9/11. So what were they doing while all this was going on? Well, George Bush was attending a school in Florida to talk about education. Kind of a contradiction in terms, but there we go. Now, just after, I was in a bar just after 9/11, which I tend to be, and I was watching CNN on the bar television, and they were live at a public meeting in Florida, which was George Bush's first town meeting after 9/11. And he was asked by a little boy called Jordan what he thought and what was going on with him at the time that the attacks were going on. Well, Jordan, he said, I knew immediately I had to act. Well, he never did that for a start. That's the last thing he bloody did. But then, wait for this. He said, I was at a school, he said, and they had a television, he said, and I saw this plane hit the World Trade Center. And he said, what he said, I've got the tape. He said, and I thought, what a terrible pilot. What he bloody said, right? Now, then he goes into the classroom, and then he's told about the second plane hitting the World Trade Center. Now, reel back, deep breath. The first plane hitting the World Trade Center was not seen live on television. It was only filmed by a crew doing a documentary on New York fire crews. Later, it came to light. The live one was the second one, and when the second one hit, he is in the classroom. What is he talking about that he saw the first plane hit? Impossible. Next morning, I buy the papers because I'm waiting for people to say, what's he talking about? Nothing. So, let's just, and also it's very clear, as I document in Alice in Wonderland, that he knew about all this stuff going on. Of course he did. He was told that these hijackings were underway. Even if he wasn't aware and in on the whole thing, I would suggest otherwise, but he would have been told as a matter of course that, hey, we've got problems with these planes. So he's saying that the first thing he knew about it was when he saw a plane hit the World Trade Center he couldn't have seen, and then said, what a terrible pilot. So let's just take him as far that he's the president and he now knows that a aircraft full of people has hit the World Trade Center. What does he do now? He goes into a classroom to hear a story and read a story about a pet goat. That's what his reaction is. This man was a hero after 9/11. There you go, Bush and the pet goat story. I like it. Good symbolism. So then, this famous picture, Andrew Carr, the White House Chief of Staff, comes in, and according to Bush, what Card's supposed to have said was impossible because Card was not talking to him for long enough to say it. So it's all a bloody lie. But anyway, what Card was supposed to have said was, Mr. President, America's under attack. Another plane has hit the World Trade Center. What does Bush do now? The President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief, now knows that two airliners have hit the World Trade Center. What does he do? He sits there for another 20-odd minutes hearing a story about a pet goat. You don't even read it the right way up either. So now we know what really was said by Andrew Card. He came in and said, Mr. President, America's under attack. Another plane's hit the World Trade Center. And Bush said, okay, Andy, as soon as I know what's happened to this goat, I'll be right out. ...9/11 Commission. Response to the hijackings was slowed by difficulty getting secure communications among the president in Florida, officials in Washington. Rubbish! There were no communications because they weren't meant to be. Then he does his speech saying next to nothing. And then he heads for the plane. Don't rush, George. No problem. There we go. Hey, what's on telly tonight, honey? Now, this is the other one. They said, if you remember, that there was a phone call, which they took seriously, that said Air Force One is next. And that was one of the explanations for why Bush didn't head straight back and get on with it in Washington. And then about 2 weeks later, they had to admit it was a bloody lie, and the call was never made and never received. But the other question is, if they said this call, Air Force One is next, why was the first thing they did was drive the president from the school to Air Force One and take him off in the bugger? I mean, what worked that one out? There's not one strand in this official story that fits with another. Where was Rumsfeld, the defense secretary? Well, we know where he says he was, because I have the tape of him on Larry King Live just after 9/11. He was asked, what was happening with you that day? He said, I was hosting at the Pentagon in my office, on the other side of the Pentagon from where it was hit, a congressional meeting of people on the threat of terrorism. Oh, good diary decision, rummy boy. He said, and what happened, he said, was during this meeting, someone came in and handed me a note saying the World Trade Center had been hit. Now, these are his words. He said, I went to get a CIA briefing, and about 15 minutes later, I felt this jarring thing, which was the Pentagon being hit. Okay, we have a timeline. Thank you very much. The Pentagon was hit about 20 to 10. Go back 15 minutes when he received the note, in his own words, saying the World Trade Center has been hit, and you are at 25 past 9. He is saying, in his office, down the corridor from the command center that is designated to respond to hijackings, that he was only told at 25 past 9 about the first plane hitting at 9, and they didn't mention in the note the little fact that another bugger had hit about 3 minutes past 9. This is his explanation. It's bloody nonsense. This is the official way that they're supposed to react to these things. These are from the official regulations. The command center in the Pentagon will, with the exception of immediate responses, forward requests for Department of Defense assistance to the Secretary of State for approval. And the regulations also go on to say that the Secretary of State has to be told immediately. Rumsfeld, who is orchestrating the war on terrorism, has lied through his teeth about 9/11 and where he was and what was the involvement of him was in it. Why? General Myers. This is his story. Got the transcript on US military radio television. He was interviewed. He said that on the morning of 9/11, this man who was acting head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was on Capitol Hill to have a meeting with a guy called Senator Max Cleland. He says in this interview that before he went into the meeting, he saw on television that the World Trade Center had been hit by the first plane. What does this man do? Does he call the Pentagon? Does he see what's going on? No. He goes, he says, into his meeting with Max Cleland. He comes out of his meeting, he said, and almost immediately, he said, someone said, the Pentagon's been hit. Right? And he's told about the second plane. We have a timeline here. So the head of the US military at uniform level, headquartered in the Pentagon, has seen a plane has hit the World Trade Center. He's gone into a meeting on Capitol Hill with a senator. He's come out, he must have been around 20 to 10 when the Pentagon was hit, and he's telling us that even though the Pentagon and the command center knew exactly where he was, no one told him, A, the second plane had hit at 3 minutes past nine, or Flight 77 was heading towards the bloody Capitol. And, wait a minute, there are exercises we now know going on, orchestrated by the military, and this guy's in a meeting with Max Cleland. Lies! I talked to a guy who is involved in the military computer system that defends Australian airspace. He told me that the Australian Air Force were on high alert after 9/11 before the American Air Force were. He also told me of the system protecting the Capitol building of Canberra, Australia. He said that the system is that when you enter protected airspace over the Capitol building, you are, as a pilot, contacted by computer and asked for a four-digit code which you punch in, and if you don't punch it in, then you are taken out by computerized ground-to-air missiles. He even showed me where they were. That is the defense system for the Parliament building in Australia. The headquarters of the American military can be hit with no response whatsoever. They've even admit there's a ground-to-air defense of the White House, but not the Pentagon. Why wasn't it activated? This is why no one has to direct an assassination. It happens. The active role is played secretly by permitting it to happen. This is the greatest single clue. Who has the power to call off or reduce the usual security precautions? Who has the power? The very people who have used that horror to destroy more of our freedoms and slaughter thousands and thousands of people. That's the answer to the question. Now, little question about the Pentagon. We recall, when we think of the Pentagon being hit, of that wall falling down. That's the image that we get. That happened 20 minutes after impact. Before it fell, there's hardly a hole in the Pentagon whatsoever. What? How can that be? Well, maybe we're not being told the truth. Oh no, stands back in amazement. Can't be possible. Now, this is a 757. This is after the wall hit, not collapsed, not before. Where's the bloody plane? Where is it? There you go. The disappearing plane. Abracadabra. Oh no, they're just conspiracy theorists. They're mad. Do you know what Hitler said and the Nazis? The bigger the lie, the more we'll believe it, because they would say, no, they wouldn't lie to us that much. Oh, yes, they would. This is the wall collapse, but even then, where's the sodding plane? Never mind, before it collapsed. There we go. Where is it? Now, what's supposed to have happened is the plane came in low, smashed on the ground, and went in. Right? There is again, before the wall collapsed. Where is it? And this is the hole the other side. If it completely disintegrated, how is there a hole the other side through five or so different bloody ring levels of protection? Because something hit the Pentagon, but my goodness me, was it a plane? Now, this is the only bit of wreckage. Only bit of wreckage. I can see them now. So, plane comes in, hits the ground, crashes into the building. Where's the damage to the bloody lawn? Where? They get the gardeners in bloody quick, don't they? Now, the thing's gone, unfortunately. It just might be working. Now, look here. Here is a kind of a stall thing right next to where the thing was hit. Look at it. It's a frigging computer here, look. It's a computer. It's just been hit by a 7.5 frigging 7. How? It was hit by a small plane, possibly. I would suggest it was hit by a cruise missile, which went through a hole, bang, and out the other part of it, out the other side. Certainly was hit by a 757. So then comes the question, where the hell was the 757 and what happened to the passengers? How did they do it? Well, this is how they didn't do it. On the left are planes that the alleged hijackers trained in very badly. On the right, the kind of planes that hit the buildings. Anyone notice a difference anywhere? Eh? I feel there is somewhere in my water. This is the description of the Pentagon being hit. Ah, yeah, okay. The hijacker pilots were then forced to execute a difficult high-speed descending turn. Radar shows that Flight 77 did a downward spiral, turning almost a complete circle, just like a cruise missile can. Turning almost a complete circle and dropping the last 7,000 feet in 2.5 minutes. The steep turn was so smooth, the sources say it's clear there was no fight for control going on. Well, you just press a button with a cruise missile, there's no need to fight anybody, is there? And the complex maneuver suggests the hijackers had better flying skills than many investigators first believe. I'm not making fun of a terribly tragic event. I'm just pointing out the unbelievably ludicrous nature of this official story and this stupid media that's bought it. The jetliner disappeared from radar at 9:37. Less than a minute later, it clipped the top of the streetlights, plowed into the Pentagon at 460 miles an hour, while leaving no frickin' wreckage. Hey, my computer still works. What was that, a plane just went past? Ace pilots. It was like Dumb and Dumber. I mean, they were clueless. It was clear to me they weren't going to make it as pilots. One of the instructors of these guys. One of the instructors said, I wouldn't trust him driving a car. These two guys were supposed to be involved. They needed English lessons and flight training, but failed to keep up with either. One of them left for the Yemen for a year. It's all a cover story. It's all made up. Now, we're back to the Global Hawk. How did they do it? Remote control is how they did it. In terms of the World Trade Center anyway, I would say it's a cruise missile, it's 577. But what they have is technology, and they've had it for a long time, as I'll show now, that can fly a plane from the ground. I was watching a BBC program And it was about speed and technology and all that stuff. And it opened up with a 7547 jumbo jet leaving New York Airport for Heathrow. And it took off, and the pilot then took it off the runway, and then the computer took over. But as the program showed, the computer flew the plane, crossed the Atlantic, landed it, hitting the central line of the runway, and then applied the brakes. That's what the computer did. All you have to do is get control of that computer system from the ground, away you go. That's what they do with this, the unmanned Global Hawk. Wingspan of a large plane, comparatively. Now, Operation Northwoods. This shows just how far back this goes. It came to light, this, when a guy called James Bamford, a former producer with ABC, started writing a book about the National Security Agency. And in his research, he came up with this document about Operation Northwoods. This was a operation 40 years ago, orchestrated by the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, to bomb American targets, sink ships, down planes, and blame it on Castro's Cuba to justify an invasion of Cuba. This is 40 years ago. This is part of what Bamford says. The plan called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees fleeing Cuba to be sunk on the high seas, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit. Planes would be hijacked using phony evidence. All of it would be blamed on Castro. Official document, 50 years ago. My goodness, talk about history repeating. Now, what was one of the things involved in this series of manufactured terrorism? It was for an aircraft at Elgin Air Force Base to be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. At a designate time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft. God, losing my voice. And would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted into a drone, controlled from the ground. Takeoff times of the drone aircraft and the actual aircraft would be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida, where one would land and the drone would go on. What would then happen, the document says, is it would be sent over Cuban airspace, which is why they were going to pick a route that involved going over there. They would explode the plane by radio control and then say it had been downed by a ground-to-air missile by the Cubans. Like I say, this gang are nothing if not predictable. And who are involved with developing the remote-controlled aircraft and stuff? NORAD. That's what they did on 9/11. And what if, I'm not saying, but what if, and I'm coming more and more to this conclusion, that some of these so-called hijackers thought they were part of an exercise. And they get on a plane and boom, they're not part of an exercise anymore. They're the Fall Guys. Quite possible. Or it's possible they weren't even on it. Now, black boxes, two in every plane. Data recorder, cockpit conversation recorder. Where the hell are they? When you read of the capacity these black boxes have for surviving incredible heat, impact, everything, there's no way they didn't survive. Why haven't we heard what they contain? Because if we see and hear it, we'll destroy the official story. We don't see and hear it. The hijackers. 19 hijackers. FBI said they hadn't got a clue that was coming. They named the bloody hijackers in next to bloody no time. Funny how seven are still alive. At least. What did they do? Parachute? I was on one of these mainstream kind of talk shows in somewhere in America, Seattle, I think, somewhere. And I said about, you know, seven of the hijackers are still alive. You know, mainstream media have tracked them down. And he said, "What are you saying? They survived the crash?" Oh. I thought, you're a mainstream talk show host, aren't you? I feel it. No, they weren't on the bloody plane, mate. This is the official FBI timeline for Mohammed Attar and Abdulaziz Alamouri on the morning of 9/11. Now, you have been orchestrating this for years, apparently. And so you're going to get Flight 11 from Boston Logan. What do you do the night before to make sure you get on the plane you're going to hijack? You go to Portland, Maine. You drive to Portland, Maine, and you stay overnight in a hotel. And then you come back on a commuter flight, which if you miss it, you don't get on Flight 11. And even then, the timings of landing and takeoff, any little delay, you're not going to get on it. That's what you do. Now, this is the official timeline that morning. FBI say that Alamouri and Attar, the ringleader, checked out of their hotel on the morning of September the 11th at 5:33 to catch a plane, the only plane they can get to hit the hijacked plane, at 6 o'clock, 27 minutes before takeoff. In that time, they have to drive their hire car to the airport, park it, they have to get to departure, check-in, they have to go through security and get on the plane. Well, the alarm clock not go off, what happened, do you know? Abdul, get up, bloody hell! Knickers and shirts, cases, everything, get out! It's insane! And of course they left Qurans everywhere, didn't they? They must have had boxes of them. I mean, what were they? The Islamic equivalent of the Gideons? Who were these people? Unbelievable. Then there's the passport. The hijacker's passport, found near Ground Zero. I sat in my front room and I watched a BBC newsreader tell me that the FBI had announced that they found a hijacker's passport near Ground Zero, and she never laughed. Paper passport, massive fireball. I'm not a physics major, but... I asked them about it, and they said, oh no, we can't talk about that, because it's part of the investigation, the ongoing investigation. In other words, it don't exist, does it? I said, okay, they said. A year after that, an ITV crew documentary on 9/11, I asked the FBI about the hijacker's passport, and this is their quote. They said, the hijacker's passport is a rumor that might be true. It was a quote. They called a news conference after 9/11 to say they found it. Well, if they said they found it, they must have seen it. Now it's a rumor that might be true. Now, what is this? What is this? This is the knowledge that people do not retain detail. They forget what's been said here. And what they're trying to say, they know that people get their sense of perception from a sort of vague image. So immediately after 9/11, they're trying to sell the Islamic hijacker story. So the passport. Oh, see, it is them Islams that found the passport. Then they forget about it. Because what that lie has been designed to do has had its effect. Don't talk about it anymore. What about that passport? Oh, no. Rumor, might be true. That's how they do all the time. They're about selling an image. So we have Attar and Abdulaziz Alamouri rushing to the bloody airport, it seems. Nah. This, people say, no, they were definitely on the plane because there was that security footage. No, that was not at Boston Logan, this picture. It was at Portland, Maine. Isn't it funny? I went to Boston Logan, part of my research for the book. Of all the international airports in all the world, at a time when cameras are exploding everywhere, name me the international airport that does not have cameras in its departure lounge, Boston Logan. Yeah. So, this is the picture we got of Alamouri and the Attar. Now, what it says is 9/11/01, 5:45, 13 seconds. Well, they left their hotel at 5:33. They must have bleeded flown from there then. The plane must have been in the car park. 5:33. Oh, but then, that's what you see in the middle. When you expand it, oh, there's something else here. 5:53:41. About 6 minutes to six, which is why the check-in people said they were sweating blood and said they were running late. I called the head of security at Portland, Maine, and said, why do you have two time codes on that video? Oh, she said, I don't know. I said, well, could you check and ring me back, have a look at the video? She said, I can't. It was confiscated by the FBI on 9/11. That was a planted one in the center. Why would you put a time code in the center of a security video when you're trying to recognize people? To hide the fact that your story doesn't make sense. I'm not saying he wasn't on Flight 11 at all, but there's no bloody evidence that he was that I've seen worth the name. Mohammed Abdulaziz Al-Amouri. He was pictured here. Looks like he's going to die the next day, doesn't he? Look, there you go. Just like the London bombers were joking with each other as well. And this is the night before. That's Abdulaziz Al-Amouri, we're told. It's not Al-Amouri. That's Al-Amouri, a Saudi airline pilot who went into the consulate, a US consulate, on September the 11th in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and asked why he was being named as a hijacker. Just one of them. This guy, Lotvi Raisi, was jailed on the say-so of the FBI for helping train some of these pilots. He's a guy who lives in England. And he was jailed for 5 months as extradition proceedings were underway. And a judge eventually released him because the FBI offered no evidence against him whatsoever in the end. They were saying that this man was an Islamic extremist when he's married to a French Roman Catholic. So, that's just one story. How many people are in this place who've done nothing? Most of them, I would say. Look at it. The land of freedom. Geneva Convention makes it illegal for prisoners of war to be shown and pictured humiliated, and the United States does not do that. Donald Rumsfeld. What's that? Look at these people. Would you buy a used car? Not even a new one, mate. Straight off the bloody production line. Then there's this. Amazing how there was a reluctance to investigate why the buildings collapsed as they did. Engineers have said that they were just not allowed to investigate properly because the rubble was taken away by controlled demolition. Paid by the government, just like they were in Oklahoma. And there was no investigation to find out what actually happened to those buildings. Now, these are shots of the World Trade Center buildings collapsing. There's a World Trade Center building collapsing here. These are other buildings that are collapsing due to a controlled demolition. I notice a similarity there myself. Oh no, the metal got too hot. These are buildings that did not collapse through controlled demolition. They do not turn to dust. This guy, William Rodriguez, was a hero. Fated, there he is with Bush, for what he did in 9/11. He worked at the World Trade Center. And he was a hero until he came out and said that bombs went off in the building. And people around him at the time have confirmed that bombs went off in the building. It was brought down, and so a fireman said that. This guy, Larry Silverstein, owner of the World Trade Center, Building 7 came down long after the other two, and Building 7 wasn't hit, and yet it came down the same. Look, lovely controlled demolition. And Silverstein has said, although he's now trying to deny it, he said publicly that there was a controlled demolition of Building 7 on the advice of the authorities. How long does it take to charge a building to bring it down like that? A few hours? Are you joking? Everywhere you look, it's an obvious scam. As someone's pointed out, some plane experts, this engine found around Ground Zero is a 737. How come? The whole story is a monumental lie because it is a cover story to create a problem to change the nature of society. So, you've got to hide the secret agenda, so you use the movie to do so. Will you lie first or shall I? I thought that was very appropriate. You know, put your hand on you. That's a Freemasonic symbolic place to put your hand. And use people's emotions when you know who's really behind it. I mean, the real actors are not in Hollywood. Turn it into a black and white situation. You're either with us or with the terrorists. Don't focus on the fact that your targets are devastated also by what's happened. Just focus on the images that you want to bring about the desired reaction. And oh, like I say, this is a long, long old story. This is the Nazi talking. Why, of course, the people don't want war. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of their leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for their lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It happens, it works the same in every country. Hermann Göring. Exactly. As Abraham Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. He who molds opinion is greater than he who enacts laws. And he might have added, if you can mold opinion, you can enact any law you bloody choose to. And as Hitler said in Mein Kampf, all propaganda must be so popular and on such an intellectual level that even the most stupid of those towards whom it is directed will understand it. People can be made to perceive paradise as hell and the other way round to consider the most wretched sort of life as paradise. Keep it simple. Al-Qaeda, bad guy. Us, John Wayne, good guy. Keep it simple. And that's why the propaganda is at that simple level, because they don't want any complexity that people might not get it immediately. This is Tony Blair holding up the evidence against Bin Laden. This is Tony Blair holding the file of evidence against Bin Laden. And this is the Americans looking at the evidence against Bin Laden. There we go, we sorted it all out. There we go, we're away. There we go. Lies, 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 lies. I'm sorry, that's all I can say. All my other lies are classified. There we go. All right, Rumsfeld. You see what Bush said after 9/11, they are harboring a terrorist, speaking of Afghanistan, and they need to hand him over. There's no need to discuss innocent or guilt. We know he's guilty because it's in the song sheet. And so Bin Laden, and you know, this whole Bin Laden thing is just so masked in smoke and mirrors. I mean, they created him as a front man. And this is a picture of, supposed to be of Bin Laden, and this is Bin Laden in the apparently confession video, in which he doesn't actually confess. Now, either they're not the same person, or he's had a number of visits from the Kandahar Cream Cake Company, one of the two. And also had a visit from the Kabul Nose Job Clinic, cave visits a speciality, you know. In this confession video, the Americans and the British were making major inroads into Afghanistan. They were not long from taking Kabul, other places had been taken, and they never even talked about the fact there was a war going on. And this is what Greg Strauss, the visual effects supervisor at Pixel Envy, who worked on the Titanic movie and others, said. That's how we make our money, kind of faking things to convince everyone else it's real. We just did some Nike commercials where half the people are digital, you wouldn't be able to pick them out. And we're now in that realm where what you see is not what you're necessarily seeing. Well, it's in that realm all the time, but in terms of technology. When I watched a movie called with my son called Stuart Little, about a little mouse, and I watched the cat speaking human words and the mouths moving so amazingly authentically, I thought anything is possible now in terms of orchestrating us seeing things that we think we're seeing that we're not actually seeing. This is what he said in this confession video, this Bin Laden guy. We did not reveal the operation to them until just before they boarded the planes. I can picture the scene. Hey guys, listen. Listen, they're boarding. Now, you know those two big buildings in New York? It is insane. And it is an insult to those who lost loved ones. An insult. This is what the 9/11 Commission said. The 9/11 date was selected 3 weeks before the attacks. Oh, please. Only 2 days before the attacks, they still had not agreed what the targets were to hit. Oh, me goodness. You ever see that movie, Wag the Dog? We're living it. We're living it. For those who haven't seen it, Wag the Dog is a story of a president that is about to go into an election for a second term, but he's got a problem with a story of a relationship with a woman coming out. So what they do is they get a Hollywood producer, played by Dustin Hoffman, to orchestrate a war in Albania, with Albania, that doesn't actually happen except in a Hollywood studio. And they send footage to the media organizations who just play it as if it's back coming from Albania, and it's coming from a studio. And what they do is put the war with Albania on the front page and make sure the problem with the woman, does not get publicized until after the bloody election, at least, when he's re-elected. We're seeing this now. It's a manufactured movie that we're watching. And this is why these three people did everything they could to even stop having a 9/11 investigation, rubbish as it was. And the first person they wanted to head it when they were forced into it was Henry Kissinger. There is not a fiber of this man's body that is not Illuminati. And he's still everywhere. I mean, the first head of operations in Iraq after the invasion, Paul Bremer, he's a Kissinger clone with Kissinger Associates. But what you do is you ignore the detail, like I say, and you focus on image. Keep that image going. Manufacture the emotion. You have to, because you don't have the ability to empathize. Focus on one man, but only for a while. And talk about freedom while taking it away. And at least 3,000 civilians in the initial attacks on in the attacks on America are followed by at least 5,000 civilians in the initial attacks in Afghanistan. And somehow, it's a glorious victory. Just focus on that. That is terrorism. That is fighting for justice. That is evil. That is doing God's will. They're both freaking terrorism. The difference is one's on a much greater scale. It's funny how these people can say, he's a terrorist, no problem, the media will report that. I was on a live BBC program, and it was supposed to be an entertainment program, but fortunately George Michael had just come out with his video lampooning Bush and Blair, and they asked me a question about it. And they said, what do you think about it? I said, the only problem is, I said, he didn't go far enough. What he should have said is Bush and Blair are terrorists, responsible for the deaths of thousands of people. The woman went white. I think that ear was going off, because you cannot say that, even though they can say it of other people and it's reported, no problem. Definition of a terrorist: one who favors or uses terror-inspiring methods of governing or coercing government or community, hence terrorism. Terrorism! I wonder if blowing the leg off a 16-year-old ice cream vendor in Afghanistan might just come under that definition. I think it might. And all this other stuff that's followed in this glorious victory. This was Afghanistan before the bloody bombs started dropping. Stone Age country in the middle of a famine. They were dropping food parcels that looked almost the same as unexploded bomblets, blowing kids to pieces when they thought they were going to get something to eat. They got control of all satellite photographs of Afghanistan while it was going on, so that they could hide what they were doing, targeting civilians. And people said, oh no, we mustn't let Nazi Germany happen again. We have! Osama bin Laden, created by the CIA, wanted by the FBI. Amazing but true. These tunnel complexes of the Al-Qaeda network were actually funded by the CIA through Pakistan Intelligence and the Saudi royal family, and they were built by bin Laden Construction. Mirror image. Mirror image. Two expressions of the same force. And then there was all that anthrax, remember that? Cheney says anthrax packages are very worrying, said this headline. So I wrote underneath, well, stop sending them then, Dick. Have you noticed when they found that it came out that the anthrax was a strain only used by the American military, the anthrax alert scare suddenly disappeared? Oh, very funny. Part of it was about oil, but not all of it. They wanted pipelines, and they couldn't build them across Afghanistan while the Taliban was in power, even though they tried desperately to do so, and they fated the Taliban, no problem with terrorism then, and offered them lots of money, but it never came to pass. They removed them. The pipeline was going to be built by Unocal, and it was going to involve access to the Caspian Sea oil and gas fields, which is a feeding frenzy for Halliburton, Dick Cheney, Pennzoil, Bush family, Chevron, Condoleezza Rice, and all the others. Delta and Amir were with the project of the oil pipeline across Afghanistan. Delta and Amir are Bin Mahfouz and Alamoudi, the two people who were named by the State Department as funders of Osama bin Laden and terrorism, etc. It's a very small world. Dick Cheney, when he was Defense Secretary during the bombing and what have you, and the Gulf War, destroyed many of the oil installations of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. As Chief Executive Officer of Halliburton, his subsidiary Brown & Root was paid massive sums by Iraq to replace the damaged oil facilities that Cheney's military had damaged. It's good for business. Prior planning, prior knowledge. Whenever you're playing a problem, reaction, solution, this is an advert, actually, about a year before 9/11. Whenever you're playing problem, reaction, solution, the solution is always in place before the problem is played. And a guy called Nayaz Nayak, who was a former Pakistan foreign minister, he said immediately after 9/11, before the Afghanistan invasion was talked about, he had been told in the summer of 2001 at a meeting in Berlin by American officials that they planned to invade Afghanistan before the snows came in the winter, and they were going to remove the Taliban. Now, there was no way that that was going to be justified to the public without 9/11. With 9/11, it was a piece of cake, but they were planning to do it. There we go. And what Nayaz Nayak said was that part of the plan was that Zahir Shah, the exiled king of Afghanistan, exiled in Rome, would be brought back to Kabul to live in the presidential palace. After the invasion of Afghanistan, he's back in the presidential palace with Hamid Karzai and all that stuff, who's another front man for this whole thing, just a gopher. The British, who took part in the invasion of Afghanistan, did not head for Afghanistan after 9/11. The biggest military and naval force to leave Britain since the Falklands War left Portsmouth, England on September the 3rd for an exercise in Oman. And when by the time they got there, they were in a position in Oman to join the invasion of Afghanistan, exactly as planned. It's all in the song sheet. And then you have the Karzai and Shah and all that stuff. And these things are able to be orchestrated because of this structure. And a lot of the people on the ground who are part of it don't know who's ultimately pulling the strings. It works like this. It's pyramids within pyramids. So you've got a pyramid that encompasses the United States and British governments, the CIA, FBI. And you've also got pyramids that encompass terrorist groups and stuff and groups in the Islamic world who are also controlled by the Illuminati. And eventually you've got a pyramid that encompasses them both. And from that level of the pyramid, you can orchestrate making something happen, organizing the patsies if necessary, and also organizing the non-reaction to the event and what follows in terms of a solution afterwards. That's how it works. And a lot of these so-called suicide bombers and other people involved in this stuff, they don't know ultimately who's controlling them, who's controlling the whole thing. They only know the next person up, this compartmentalization. And this is how it works. With one force controlling both sides, that's the movie, that's what's really happening. The solution, of course, has been more and more controls and taking away of our freedoms, more and more surveillance, getting people to spy on each other and all the rest of it. And I love this. This is an FBI document calling for help from the public. And it talks of one of the things to watch for are defenders of the US Constitution against the federal government. This is what Adolf Hitler said when he was justifying the creation of the Gestapo. An evil exists that threatens every man, woman, and child of this great nation. We must take steps to ensure our domestic security and protect our homeland. Could have been George Bush, could have been Tony Blair. And so we go back to Babylon and the invasion of Iraq. Of course, Daddy's always here in the background. He was the one that orchestrated the invasion or the war with Iraq in 1991. This guy, Saddam Hussein, was part of the gang, part of the secret society gang, a blue-eyed boy, until he was surplus to requirements, because that's what they do. These people are used and fated and supported while that suits the agenda. The moment destroying them suits the agenda, they destroy them. They're just fodder in the game. In the what happened in 1991, they had got the Iraqi forces in such a state, they only had to, you know, pay for the gas to get to Baghdad, and it was all over. And then suddenly, staggering to everybody, Father Bush says, no, we're not going any further. And leaves Saddam in power, because that card was needed to be played again. Because this is like a... they don't just project a few weeks or months forward. It's like a biorhythm chart that they've got going forward, orchestrating these events towards this agenda. Even during the so-called end of the war after 1991, people were being bombed in the so-called no-fly zone areas of Iraq. This is a young... child, 6 years old, found dead in the rubble, American bombs. Her sister was also killed in this bombing. This is what wasn't reported, going on all through the 90s. This is what is happening, and has been happening since 1991, and my goodness, what's happening now, to children who are being born as a result of the exposure of parents to the radiation in the spent uranium and all that stuff, in the bombs that they drop these days. Horrendous birth defects. And of course, since this latest invasion, the amount of radiation, the amount of pollution has dramatically increased. This is what Americans don't see and British people don't see. What is going on in Iraq and what is not reported. And this is even before this invasion. Before the invasion, of course, this is what they said. They said, although we've not removed Saddam Hussein, even though we could have done, we've still got a problem with Saddam Hussein, so what we've got to do is have sanctions against Iraq. The sanctions during the 90s, supported by the American government and Tony Blair, led to unbelievable devastation in that country. This is the UN, December 1995. More than 1 million Iraqis had died, 567,000 of them children, as a direct consequence of economic sanctions. As many as 12% of the children surveyed in Baghdad are wasted, 28% stunted, and 29% underweight. This is even before they started dropping the bombs this time. UNICEF, 1996, more than 4,500 children under the age of 5 are dying each month from hunger and disease as a result of the sanctions. Madeleine Albright was asked on CBS 60 Minutes, we have heard that 500,000 children have died as a result of sanctions in Iraq. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State to Clinton. I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it. And when we talk about America and Britain, we're not really talking about the American people and the British people, although those who support the people doing this, you know, have a massive responsibility. But America and Britain are merely vehicles as countries for the Illuminati to orchestrate this global agenda. They're no more important than any other country, except that they are centers for the Illuminati and are being used. And when they went into Iraq, it was about control and takeover. And these two are major frontmen, and that's about the way the relationship seems to work. Certainly, that's the way the British see Blair. There we go. Go on. So, we've got missiles, tanks, troops, planes, bombs, ships, guns. Now, we need a reason. Weapons of mass destruction, that'll do. And see, problem, reaction, solution doesn't even need a... Scott Ritter, who was a chief UN weapons inspector. What he's saying here before the invasion of Iraq is that they have no weapons of mass destruction. The mainstream media ridiculed him. He was right. But you don't need a real problem often with problem, reaction, solution. You just need the perception of it. So problem, weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein, dangerous to our welfare. So, reaction, oh my God, we must do something. Solution, invade Iraq. I talk about it in detail. It's an amazing story, the way it was orchestrated. And what's happened now is, through secret Downing Street memos that have been leaked and stuff, is already we are officially back a year before the invasion to where it was shown that they'd already agreed to invade. In days before the invasion, no, it's not necessarily going to happen if he does this and he does that. Joke. That's why the UN weapons inspectors were ridiculed and humiliated. It's because they didn't want them to find no weapons of mass destruction. So there we go. There was a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. Look, there we go. No problem. I know that was another one. He was flying one of the planes. There we go. And that, it gets sillier and sillier. There's the evidence of weapons of mass destruction. There's the Americans looking at it. There's one of the weapons of mass destruction. And there's one of the mobile weapons laboratories. There we go. Away we go. And interesting, 1983, Donald Rumsfeld was sent by Reagan Bush to Baghdad to meet Saddam Hussein and organize the shipment from American companies of chemical and biological weapons to use against the Iranians. And people say, oh, Saddam Hussein, terrible man. He used chemical weapons against the Kurds. Yes, and who supplied them? American and British companies. And it's not make-believe, this is an official document. Came to light a couple of years ago or so. Donald Rumsfeld, the US Defense Secretary, and one of the most strident critics of Saddam Hussein, this is a newspaper report, the document, met the Iraqi president in 1983 to ease the way for US companies to sell biological and chemical weapons, including anthrax and bubonic plague cultures, according to newly declassified US government documents. He was a director of a company called ABB, a big engineering giant in Europe, and what they did is they sold nuclear equipment to North Korea. And now he's saying North Korea is a danger because it has nuclear technology. You couldn't make it up. Agenda, movie, and the same people move between the two, like him. But follow the white rabbit. War is peace. Get a brain, morons. And away we go. Shocking, awful. And John Wayne everywhere. Hey, John Wayne. It's the mentality. It's like a B-bloody movie that's unfolding, but not at the sharp end of it. All over the Iraq and all over the place, this is going on. I won't even go into some of this stuff. Cluster bombs are used in Iraq and they've been used in Afghanistan. That's what cluster bombs do. That's what cluster bombs do. When they explode, they send out hundreds of sharp, razor-sharp pieces of metal that just cut people to pieces. They're actually supposed to be illegal, but clearly, provably, the Americans and the British governments are using them. And this is what I get with morality. We've got this perverted view of morality, you know. When Janet Jackson, in this orchestrated exposure with Justin Timberlake, was it at the Super Bowl, there was moral bloody outrage from so many people in this country. Oh, it's terrible! Oh, what's happening to America? The moral fiber is falling apart! Well, I just wonder what people find more offensive. Someone bearing their bloody breast in public, or that. If we got more morally outraged by that on a large scale, then maybe it wouldn't happen. I'm up to here with a moral sodding majority. Oh, yes. This is what one of the soldiers said in a British documentary. We bomb them, you know, it's cool to me because I like explosions and stuff like that, but I don't get to see the actual explosion, and that's what I want to see. But I guess when we get closer to Baghdad, we'll get to see more of that. It's just a movie, it's a game, it's a virtual reality game. And oh my God. And this is what... Even the troops are fodder. Have you noticed that? You get people like Bush and these other people, these kind of people that want to go and bomb people, and they say, we must fight terrorism. We must go and stop Saddam Hussein. Well, we are drinking Jack Daniels while watching the White House freaking television. We are working in a bank. We are working in the local store. We ain't fighting in Iraq. We send other poor buggers to do that. And you know, I've got a great way of stopping war. We just have a law that anyone who declares war has to fight on the front line from day one, right? End of war. If Georgie boy had been on the front line in Iraq when the first bullet was fired, he'd have been under a bed in Houston when the second bugger went off. This is what a surgeon in Germany talked about, the horrors of what's happening to troops coming back from Iraq, maimed. Don't see that in the mainstream media. They don't want us to see this because they have to sell more and more people the idea of joining the military. Henry Kissinger once famously referred to the military as dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy. Wag the dog. And the greatest thing we can do is to not join the military. Isn't that great line in the 60s? What if we had a war and no one turned up? Hey, what a great idea. All this was orchestrated propaganda. And it's kind of funny. This is what the view of that square was when that... statue of Saddam Hussein was being pulled down. I was in America at the time. I sat and watched just to see how long they would hold on it. CNN held on that square live for 2 hours until that statue was pulled down by the military because of its symbolic nature. Now, you've just seen that square. This is the London Evening Standard picture of the people in that same square at that time. Where are they again? Now look, this guy at the front is in there at least four bloody times. What they've done is they've taken clips of thought number of people and they've put them together to create a crowd. This is a mainstream newspaper in Britain. Yeah. Jessica Lynch. Manufactured story, wag the dog. And again, face experts, you know, in Britain and... elsewhere, but I've seen at least two of them talking about it in Britain. They've said that there's at least 7, 8, or 9 Saddam Husseins. And it was accepted he had loads of doubles, but have they got Saddam Hussein? Have they got Saddam Hussein batch number 156/X? And there's this story, I really saw this. Saddam Hussein's wife arrived from Syria with her official escort and then entered the prison. Emerging only moments later, pink with rage and shouting, "This is not my husband, but he's double. Where's my husband? Take me to my husband." American officials rushed forward to shield Mrs. Saddam from perplexed Russian observers, trying to insist that Saddam had changed a lot while in custody. And she probably didn't recognize him. This was certainly not the best way to handle the Iraqi president's wife. "You think I do not know my husband?" she shouted furiously. "I was married to the man for more than 25 years. Then she stormed off, never to return. Reported in Pravda and 4 other newspapers that I saw. Oh dear, let's go to the cinema and watch this world unfold. The pig trough, oh, more of the resources and stuff all being picked off by the American companies. And handing over Babylon. I love it. Oh, we're going to hand it over to the Iraqis. This guy, watch your pocket, Shalabi, found guilty in Jordan of embezzling multi-millions. He operated a organization called the Iraqi National Congress, funded by the CIA, and they were one of the organizations that said, he's got weapons of mass destruction and we can prove it. He is a front man for the CIA, etc. The first interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, CIA MI6. War is peace, death is freedom, occupation is liberation, we don't want your oil. Hey, we're just working for God, because I'm Jesus in a suit. Kill them all. Wanted for crimes against humanity. If these guys really were prosecuted for what they've done, then they would have to reincarnate many times to complete the sentence. This is where we're leading. And you know, when I and others talk about fascism and Nazi Germany, but it's not some extreme fantasy. It is what is happening. In London this week, they shot a guy 5 times from close range. And the media just say, it must have been necessary. It must have been a danger to the public. Well, they don't know that. Investigate. But you reach the point of fear where the public accept, yes, well, you just got to shoot on sight. You never know. He might have a bomb. That's love. I love that one. I love that one. That's perfect. That is sum it up. And again, they've told us in the Project for the New American Century report that I talked about earlier, they are heading for these other countries, and the countries either come quietly or they start getting bombed. Stop asking questions. Promise never to question authority. I promise never to bring up my rights. And if you do, if you stand for freedom and peace and not killing people, what they do is they shoot at you with rubber bullets and they break up your peaceful protests. And they stop people having a voice to protest and put the other point of view. Why? Well, let's go back to the Nazis. That's all you have to do. This is what the propaganda minister Goebbels said. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus by extension the truth becomes the greatest enemy of the state. That's why they're suppressing dissent. And in Britain, we've got the Neo-Labour Party, who's just the mirror of what's happening in America, and we've got Belair, as they call him in Britain. And this is... This brings us to very topical events, and we'll have a break in a second, but this brings us to very topical events. As a result of the information that's come out about the invasion of Iraq and the lack of weapons of mass destruction, and the staggering scale of lies that Blair has told and Bush has told, I'm not kidding, in Britain, the word Blair and liar are interchangeable in the public mind. This man won another election, but with 36% or something like that of the vote. 64% voted against him. Because of the ludicrous system in Britain, he got in. Now, we were in a situation where you had two front men that were supposed to push forward this agenda. In Britain, he had no credibility whatsoever. And in America, Bush's support and ratings were plummeting, as was the support for Iraq. And so something had to happen, and it was the London bombings. It was a very orchestrated week in Britain. First of all, in London, you had the Live 8 concert with the rock stars putting on this concert to press for help for Africa. They weren't, I won't say they were played like a violin. More appropriately, they were played like electric guitars. Because they were used to give A, the impression that something was going to be done about Africa when it was all a sleight of hand. And secondly, it was part of a sequence of events through that week that led to these bombings, all orchestrated to manipulate the public mind. Bob Geldof, I'm not saying he's not genuine, but this man really has got to get streetwise. The idea that these guys want to do something about Africa, as I've been saying for years, the agenda is to destroy Africa. It's a genocidal agenda of which AIDS, what we call AIDS, is a massive part, to destroy and kill what we call the African culture, the African people. And this Live Aid concert was giving the impression that these people were going to do something about it when they were actually doing the opposite. It was hiding the genocide in so many ways. I mean, they're reducing debt. Well, there is no sodding debt for a start. It's just credit. And what is the debt? The debt is money that is not passed on. Credit is passed on. And it's often wasted because of front men in African countries that are placed there by Illuminati to do that. And what is debt? It's control. And aid. Bloody aid. For every dollar that goes into Africa in aid, $3 comes out to the aid-donating countries in exploitation of Africa. Not only that, one of the great ways that they use to pass money directly from government to transnational corporations, from taxpayer to corporations, is via aid. Because this is the way it works. They say, if they said, right, what we're going to do, we're going to write out a check to Halliburton, or we're going to write out a check to this company or that company, here's some taxpayers' money. People say, what's going on? What's going on? So what they do is they say, hey, over here, we are now giving aid to this country. Hey, because we're good. Well, we're British, we're American, and we care. So here's some aid. Hey, get the photo. There you go. Hey. Then what happens is you go, oh, by the way, I'll be with you in a minute. Go and have a drink, okay? Great. By the way, that money, it has to be spent with this company on that project, okay? Thanks very much. Okay. Now, I'm with you again. And so what a large amount of aid is passing money from governments through the receiving country back to the transnational corporations in the donating countries. That's how they do it. And another thing that happened was so symbolic of the patronizing of Africa is that you had the white rock stars here on the major stage in London in Hyde Park. And only after complaints from people saying what's going on were some African bands put on miles away down in Cornwall in England, watched by a few thousand people with next to no publicity. So all the white rock stars were singing on the stage, and if any Africans were there, they were in the background in the chorus. How symbolic is that? Patronizing. So then, oh, but we're good guys, look, we're doing this. So you've got the Bonos and you've got the Geldofs, and I'm not saying they're not genuine, but they've been pulled into the system to play the game. And so we are asked to believe that now, because of this pressure, that these global leaders are going to help Africa. And the organization orchestrating this help is the World Bank and the IMF, when the World Bank is headed by Paul Wolfowitz, who was one of the architects of a document that talks of developing biological weapons that can target specific genotypes. This may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Bob Geldof, mate, wake frickin' up. Please. And then the next stage of this was the G8. Now what this did, it was in Scotland, it got these world leaders together in England in that week at the right time to react to the terrorism. The next thing that happened was that London was given the Olympic Games for 2012, a key year in the Illuminati agenda, not least because it's terrified what's going to happen after it. In terms of the wake up. And when they first announced that London, this is years ago now, was going to go for the 2012 Olympics, I said to my friends, it's a bloody certainty. London Major center globally of the Illuminati, 2012 Olympics. Oh, you kidding? They're bound to get it. Oh, it was very close with Paris. No way. They were always going to get it. And so London then was absolutely a joyful, great scenes of celebration. And one of the great, most effective ways of affecting people emotionally, a trauma type way, is to have a big high and then smack them down. And so you had this great elation. 24 hours later came the London bombs on 777. And it was the most obvious setup you will ever see. Someone sent this to my website. It's interesting how the bombs kind of went off in a pyramid. I mean, it would sound fantastic, really, but these guys really do go for this sort of stuff. And interestingly, again, the symbolism, the bus, the number 30, which was diverted from its route as a result of the underground bombs, and it went off off route, on the side of it was an advertisement for a movie. And what the advertisement said was, "Outright terror, bold and brilliant." And some people have contacted me who work for London Transport, and they are desperately skeptical about the official story. But because of the way the week was orchestrated, there were the world leaders and Blair and Bush all ready to react in the desired fashion to bring about the solution to the problem. My goodness. And then we had the same scenes. We had scenes of people trying to find missing people, just like after 9/11. And then we had the celebration, the end of the week, or the commemoration of the Second World War, in which the whole London bombings thing was brought in, true Brit, it's like the Blitz spirit. In other words, when we are under threat, get behind the authorities protect us, we must come together. Don't let's call Blair the bloody liar he is, and we knew he was before, now let's rule. And this is the BBC security correspondent who actually said something very true. What they did, talking of hijackers' passports, these four bombers, who apparently were the suicide bombers or the people involved with the bombs, their documents were all on them so the police could find out who they were in absolutely no time. And as this BBC security correspondent said, "I do think it very strange that they were able to find these documents belonging to these bombers. Maybe they thought they were going to paradise, so it didn't really matter, but it allowed the police to trace where they came from very quickly. It's a strange thing to do." Well, not if you didn't know there was you were going to do it. Not if you were part of an exercise, maybe, and you thought you were part of an exercise, and then before it was too late, you realized what it was really part of. Bang. This is from an Australian newspaper. I love it. "And make sure you've got your identity cards to be found after the bombs go off." Although they're now denying it, this guy, Benjamin Netanyahu, former Israel Prime Minister and still a major political figure in Israel, he was warned not to go to a hotel near the first bomb where he was due to make a speech, and stayed in his hotel. How did they know that? And then, on the day of the bombings, the Jerusalem Post published an article by this guy, Ephraim Halevi, former head of Mossad. This is what he wrote in his article. This is on the day the bombs went off. "The multiple simultaneous explosions that took place today on the London transportation system were the work of perpetrators who had an operational capacity of considerable scope. They have come a long way since the two attacks of the year 1988 against the American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, and the aircraft actions September the 11th, 2001. There was careful planning, intelligence gathering, and a sophisticated choice of timing, as well as near-perfect execution. We are faced with a deadly and determined adversary who will stop at nothing and will persevere as long as he exists as a fighting terrorist force." Simultaneous bombs. The London police announced on the day of the bombings that the bombs went off over a period of 51 minutes. It was 2 days later before they called a news conference and said, we've now established the bombs were simultaneous. How does this bugger know, former head of Mossad, they were simultaneous on the day of the bombing? We have another exercise on our hands. BBC interviewed, on the day of the bombings, a guy who runs a consultancy company, a guy called Power, Peter Power, and he said that he was staggered because he ran this crisis management company that was doing an exercise that morning to do an exercise on a terrorist event, a fake mock-up, at exactly the same places that the bombs went off in reality that day. He said the only difference between what happened and what their exercise scenario was doing was that in their scenario, the bombs were simultaneous and not, as the police are saying, over a period of 50 minutes. 2 days later, like I say, the police announced, no, they were simultaneous. So in every single facet and detail, what happened in reality was what that exercise was doing. What if those guys were part of the exercise? And then didn't realize until it was too late that they were carrying the real thing. This is why I have to bloody laugh. I have to laugh. It's just so pathetic. Websites like mine and others and Alex Jones and many others have been asking simple questions. If they were suicide bombers, why did they buy return rail tickets from Luton to London? Why, when they parked their car in the station car park at Luton, did they put enough time on to come to London and then get back without getting fined? Why did they do that? They were suicide bombers. Now, of course, holes starting to appear. People going, oh yeah. So what they have now done is the authorities have said, well, we're not sure now if they were suicide bombers. We think that maybe, because of course they bought return rail tickets and that, maybe their Al-Qaeda controllers just didn't want them to survive in case they cracked if they were arrested and told of everyone else. So maybe they didn't realize that the bombs were going to go off when they did. That's why they bought... See, and the paper's going, oh yeah, that's probably... No, no, you're being used, darlings, to cover the obvious holes in the story, but you can't see it. Oh my God, it's pathetic. It's repeating. We're in a time where people are being picked off. Divide and rule. Okay, let's focus on the Islams. Oh, he's got a beard. He's dangerous. Oh, let's focus on these. Let's focus on that. Oh, look, homeless. Hey, there isn't a crime. All this. We're being picked off. And oh, it doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect me. And it reminds me of this very famous statement by this pastor, an anti-German activist, anti-Nazi activist rather, who said, first they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the communists and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for me and by then there was no one left to speak out for me. That is what they are seeking to do to us. And what we surely need to do is unite on what affects us all instead of being disunited on what we agree on. We are not going to be under an Orwellian state because we are Jewish, or an Orwellian state because we are American or we're South African. We are going to be in an Orwellian state because all of us will be in that position if we are divided and ruled for long enough to allow it to happen. And this, they're coming for the draft. You know, when you look at what that Project for the New American Century document is demanding, and they're looking for ways of focusing on Iran now and China and all this other stuff, they're not going to be able to fight simultaneous wars in major theater wars. Without the draft, they're struggling now to fulfill the vacancies. Plenty of vacancies available. Join the army, travel to exotic distant lands, meet exciting, unusual people and kill them, and be killed. These draft bills are already there. They can't do it without enforcing the draft. These things here, these budgets and stuff, are all in the pipeline to make it happen. And you've got these buffoons in their silly hats going round trying to persuade people who have been spit out by the system to go and fight for the bugger. I love it. You know that system that's left you jobless and poor and all that stuff? We want you to come and die for it. Oh, that's a good idea. Where do I sign? Oh, by the way, we'll pay your college fees until we need you to die for us. By the way things are going, we need you to die about the middle of next bloody month. So be quick on the revising. What Albert Einstein said, the pioneers of a warless world are the youth that refuse military service. And it's not... it's not just the youth to refuse military service, it's for those not affected to support them in refusing military service. It was absolutely on the ball. That is absolutely on the ball now. Donovan's record. He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill and he knows he always will. Killing for you, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. But without him, how could Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. Wherever he goes from there, I can't remember. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there and you and me and brothers and sisters, can you see? This is not the way we bring an end to war. It's always been true and it will always be true. And never more so than now. They can't do it without using us as fodder. If we refuse to be, they can't do it. And this is a time we're at the fork in the road and people are now starting to wake up. There were 1 million people on the streets of London. Challenging the invasion of Iraq. There are more and more people, I've been staggered by the number of people involved in relation to the London bombings who have said this is not making sense, this is not true. There is a wake up happening and we are at the forefront of it. And after we've had a half an hour break, we'll get into the part of this I love talking about. And, you know, I mean, what are we doing letting these people run the world? I mean, look at them. Look at them. Look at them. You know. What are we doing? There we go. I don't know where we are. You can tell they're royalty. They do it with their gloves on, you see. They got class. So, we'll have a half an hour break. It's 20 past four. Say 4 o'clock, and we'll come back and wrap this up with a bit of more of that. Thank you very much.